Good afternoon, I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining What Mama Wants. I think Mother Earth wants far less toxics and more health for her planet. This is a chance to hear firsthand from educators, policymakers, scientists, and today artists about the role toxics like mercury, PFAS, and pesticides are playing in our daily lives. My guest today is Dr. Susan Smith. She's an associate research professor of art and serves as the graduate coordinator for the graduate art programs in Intermedia at the University of Maine's Orono campus. Presently, her art exhibit is being shown at Lord Hall, and I am visiting with her today while looking at examples of her work. Thank you so much for being my guest today on What Mama Wants.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for coming.
It's really a delight. I've never been to the University of Maine before.
Well, we have R1 research standing, so you should come. There's some really interesting things happening in terms of environment, obviously climate change, environmental engineering, and will be the location for a huge development of a PFAS analytics lab that will be in development this summer. So the graduate art program will be the partners for outreach in the arts for that initiative. So we're looking forward to that.
I wondered if we could start by having you talk to us about this exhibit we are standing by, Radical Gardening. What was the inspiration for this exhibit? And tell us a little bit about what we're looking at.
Okay. The inspiration for this would be about 8 years ago, beginning a process of looking at my studio and the mass of fairly toxic materials that I was trying to store. And I started teaching a methods and materials class to students and just started to shift little by little my practice to a more sustainable method. And as that started to gain momentum, it felt like I was really interested in pushing it as far as I could to move into natural dye processes, natural pigments, developing my own paints, just using textiles that were recycled and upcycled. And that started to really take hold at the same time that I became, as we all have, aware of forever chemicals. And at that point, it just, one of those in the middle of the night, can't sleep. Oh my gosh, this is what I need to do. And so I began to travel, and I do a lot of travel from Maine to where I'm from, Texas. And at that point, just researching. The first trip was to find as many documented PFAS contamination sites from Maine to Texas as I could, working with maps and working with the project lab at Northeastern University. They have one of the most comprehensive sites for analytics and stories and just all kinds of data. So I used that business, research, pleasure, travel. And I also got to see by documenting these sites, the small towns, of course, that I would have never gone to, and collecting narratives and really focusing the work on the soils and the waters of these sites. They were military bases, they were industrial complexes, small little businesses, Superfund sites, elementary schools, middle schools. And so we included as many as we could driving on the first trip from Maine to Texas and back, and taking photographs and samples. And then I would go back into the studio and create inks and paint from the pigments and artwork with that, and use the water in all my natural dye processes. Whatever I was natural dyeing would be using those soils. And it started to really make me feel like, how could I really get this work out? And how can I do it with the most impact? And I thought about developing a mobile lab. And so this lab here is about 6 feet tall by about 4.5 feet wide. And it's like this great big suitcase that opens up on wheels and houses the paint making station, all of the bottles of pigments and water, as well as documentation of photographs from some of the sites. I think right now we're at about 52 sites documented.
Listeners, if you want to see these things, they'll be posted on whatmamawants.org with Dr. Susan Smith's photograph and this audio. If you want to go back and look at them, you'll get a good sense for what she's talking about. It's an unfolding portfolio display.
I owe credit to one of the graduate students in our labs, Reed Hayden, a boat builder, for helping me actually realize this and develop my design. So I want to put that credit out there. Thank you, Reed. And thank you to my partner helping me to schlep this to New York City, Massachusetts, and a number of other locations, because although I say mobile, there's so much that has to go into it. So
absolutely. You were talking about your original inspiration to start making pigments and dyes yourself because the paints you've been buying commercially, are they toxic?
Well, I was doing a lot of printmaking and a lot of use of solvents and mordants, chemicals. So yeah, there are. And I moved to a soy-based ink product in printmaking. And I have a background in landscape design. And so it just seemed like the next step in this process was to grow my own dye garden and plants or to source things from place. And so I think, although on the market now, there's a number of materials that are more sustainable, the idea of placemaking really happens with this, is that I can visit and be at a site, source the materials from windfall and leaves or soils, and give acknowledgement and research to indigenous peoples that went before, be respectful of the land, take only what's needed. So you can have a vial of maybe a half ounce of soil that can create a whole lot of paint. And so it really, I think, became more about sourcing material from a specific site, which also required me, as I'm always talking to my students about, showing up. So this idea of showing up and witnessing these sites, I could have researched to my heart's content, as we all could, about someplace like Hendersonville, Kentucky, or even Fairfield, Maine, without ever going there. But it was the actual visiting, talking to people, looking at a dairy maybe that had had to basically remove its livestock because they couldn't afford to keep it going until it could be remediated. Landfills, all those things. Once you're standing there, it's the being there and witnessing this stuff that really starts to have an impact on you and seeing what the impact is on the communities. So, for example, one of the images here is made famous by Aaron Brockovich in the, I think it's Mark Ruffalo movie. Yes, Dark Waters. And so when we visited that, we saw everything we could have probably have seen to some extent by looking at images online. But what we were able to really witness were all of the fences and the way this property was designed to keep us away. At the same time, across the street, the DuPont Corporation had developed a nature trail for people. And the water from the plant is the same. I mean, it's just the being there really makes a big difference. So I can't say also that I don't buy paper or canvas or something like that. But I've really started to focus on teaching my students ways to create just their own materials from a place that's meaningful to them.
I really love that. And I wonder, are you familiar with artists who have had toxic exposures from like cadmium in their red paints?
I have. One of my mentors used quite a bit of solvents and affected their health. And it was something I saw firsthand, as well as some practices I used to use to transfer images to paper from print with or without a mask on or protective. And I knew over time those were not good. And also, as an educator, you're passing on and modeling whatever behaviors. So yeah.
What kind of side effects do you get from solvents?
Well, in the most significant sense, it's neurological and respiratory. And so, you know, your shortness of breath or feeling dizzy. So you can imagine accumulated over time. It's not a good thing. And if it's an art practice, that's something right embedded in that is the word practice. So it's something that's repeated often. So I have been using primarily and teach, I guess, more importantly to the students the safest way possible. And to the University of Maine, here in Orno's credit, Susan Gross, our printmaking guru for many years, has developed and shifted printmaking even to a lot of non-toxic printmaking processes. So the university here also has kind of a history and a legacy in her work. So,
lovely. Thank you for that. And let's come over and take a tour of your work here.
Well, first thing is a number of little vials. I probably have about 200 of them now, and a few of them made their way to this exhibit of soil that are the pigments from various locations and water and then ink. So for example, there's two ways to make pigment. If it's an earth pigment, like an ochre, that's just grinding a powder. And so this one is from Brooklyn Elementary Community Garden here in Maine. Another one, this verdigris, is a copper pigment, super sparkly blue. Wish you could see it, but it is from Roanoke, Virginia. I believe it was called Spring Valley, but it was a reservoir outside Roanoke, Virginia. The reservoir was supplying the water forever to the community. When we visited, miles and miles of big pipe were laying on the ground outside the reservoir. And when we visited, they were in the process of installing pipe from, I believe it's like 22 miles away, to supply water to the area. And so I found some copper implements lying around, and those can be, over time, with just basic vinegar, created a verdigris pigment. Brilliant blue-green. And so one more here is Upper Dauphine Middle School in Millersburg, Pennsylvania. And that school had also shifted to bottled water because of the pollution. And those are earth pigments. And then the next shelf up here are the lake pigments. So the difference between that, a lake pigment is made from plants instead of earth. And it's a different process to create the pigment. And this one is from my hometown of Austin, Texas, Edwards Aquifer.
And it's purple.
Yes, it just depends. And that means it's plants. I have to use water for these. So the water is sourced from one of these locations and then plant material. And I think this one was some wildflowers that were growing on the side. And fracking is also another source of PFAS contamination. So this light green gray is from Fredericksburg, Texas. So there's a number of different pigments in the lake pigments. And then the top shelf here, for example, is the Ohio River, big site of PFAS contamination, been recently in the news in New Hampshire.
These are in tincture bottles, and they're yes. And they're watery. The other two were powdery. So are these distilled?
Depending on what the source is, I'll create the pigment, either earth or lake pigment, which is the plants. And then I combine it with a little bit of tree sap. And if you're going to buy it, you would buy gum arabic. You could use honey and then a little bit of the actual water. So it's site water, specific earth or plant created ink, and a little touch of either oil of wintergreen or honey, actually, depending how thick you want it, will keep it from molding over. Some of them are really viscous and thick, and some of them are fairly watery. So what I do is, when I'm ready to use them, put in another little vial and thicken it up a little bit. But you can get an entire range of color. And so I'm using all of the Ohio River, Merrimack River, depending upon the location that I got it from.
I've had a guest on my show that talks about the Merrimack River and how much PFAS is in streaming through all the towns that carry the Merrimack River.
Yes, it was incredible to visit. I think this is the image of Saint-Germain. And it was interesting that at the entrance, there were the sites that said that the EPA has designated all of their processes safe. It was all of these signs and surveillance cameras everywhere. And we were able to go around the backside where there was some water runoff and get our water there in the soil. But it's very, very interesting. For example, a corporation in Kentucky, this image here, had touted their remediation efforts as giving all the employees bottled water and installing remediation drainage. And this was the first photograph when we went back on the way back. This is a drainage ditch with a pipe coming right out of the back of the plant. And so when we went back on the way back, there was a bale of hay and a piece of black plastic. And that was initially the remediation effort. So, and that particular location was where this animal habitat formed out of clay was in to the side of the ditch. And while we were there, the lawn folks were coming through and were about to basically just obliterate this. I don't know what kind of prairie dog or whatever has this nest, but out of clay, and it was so beautiful. And so I quickly picked it up. They were about to destroy it, and started to think about the more than human. And that's really, I think that's really at the heart of what this is about, is this idea that everything that's here is ours for resource, and how we have benefited from that, and who has suffered, either Indigenous peoples in terms of land, or just all of the creatures here, whether it be livestock or plants. So,
yeah, here in Maine, we've seen that with the people suffering in Fairfield, farm to farm, and anyone using aquifers near there. But then it's in the deer. And the deer meat, and you're not supposed to eat the deer meat. And a whole different group of people woke up and started paying attention to PFAS because of that.
Absolutely. Deer, fish. It's kind of like if you started to collect something, everybody's going to send you them or give you those for Christmas. Well, every day, practically, my texts are full of posts of someone sending me an article they found. So part of the research group here on campus working with environmental engineering and folks that are working on developing takeout containers, PFAS-free, which is a big deal here on campus. And this particular square of plastic is the liner currently being used in the landfill here in Old Town at Juniper Ridge. And so I was lucky to get bags of the samples of the landfill that they were testing here, shooting what looked to me like plastic bullets in it, but trying to find a way to see how easy it was to puncture that liner, to see how effective it was in keeping the PFAS levels in.
I love art. That is so cool to see that. I just love that you brought it. I've heard about this liner. I've tried to imagine a liner, and here it is. It looks like a tire rubber.
It's really hard. I'm creating some artwork now for an exhibit that will happen at the end of this April. And most of them do have holes in them where those, this particular one didn't, where those tests have been made on it. So, yeah.
It's but like with all plastic, you know, so today it's strong. 50 years from now, it just rips apart. You know, I knew somebody was taking trash bags that had been filled with clothes that were put in a storage unit, and then they were trying to pull it out and they were just disintegrating and sticking to them. And I thought, this liner is not going to last forever.
Well, last week's news was about the sludge that they could no longer put in that landfill. That's what the tests are now. I know that they've got a lot of tests to try to do that, and also different ways of using granular activated carbon for water filtration and things like that. So my question, I guess, would be similar, is once you remove it from one thing, it goes into the water that you've used to filtrate, et cetera. And so it reminds me a little bit of the Cat in the Hat of Dr. Seuss, how that red stain can travel and travel and travel. So the researchers, they assure us that they feel like it indeed is not forever, that they will be able to find a way to remediate. And hopefully at some point we can totally, you know, cease manufacture these.
If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to What Mama Wants, Less Toxics and More Health. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is art professor Susan Smith. We are in Lord Hall on the University of Maine's campus in Orono, looking at art she's created with materials made from toxic PFAS sites gathered around the country. So right now we're on the front side. Is this what you would consider the front side of the exhibit?
I think so. It has the glass palette for mixing the paint and grinding it, and a chair. So this is kind of like the workstation here.
Let's walk around back and see what's there.
Okay. The backside has a DIY loom that I have taken Maine fiber from the Maine fiber shed and dyed that with PFAS pigments and started a basic weaving with it to show the different number of art processes. There are paintings on the front. They look like swatches of upholstery fabric. So at each side, I also have a square of canvas where I make the pigment on site and create basically small little sketch of the site. And so this is the weaving, and it uses the PFAS infused yarns. And then there's a print here of a corn stalk that is Maine from a field that's basically adjacent to a landfill and Superfund site. And so some of the research now is focusing on plants, corn being one of them, that will basically draw the PFAS up into the stalk, but it won't penetrate the ear as a potential way to remediate. And so this is a corn stalk print using walnut ink that I got also locally from the site. We have a sea encaustic on the back that has plant matter from a industry called State of the Art in Pennsylvania that's known for their aeronautic materials and PFAS contamination. And that's also something that a lot of the research that I've done makes me realize how many things we actually depend on in medical equipment, aeronautics, obviously military defense, firefighting. They're developing other kind of foams. I think they already have, but still within, especially the medical, the substitutes for things like PFAS or plastics. It's just really, it's tricky. It's tricky to think about where you even begin. So I don't have an answer. I'm just trying to make an impact with creating art that actually kind of at least helps folks. I think we can read a white paper, we can read the statistics, and those are all valid and good and important. And this is sort of as an accompaniment to that, perhaps hitting people emotionally, not that the statistics can't, but in a different way and a different point of entry. So we've had a lot of people come in with tours and things, science students come in as well as art students, and more recently, last Friday, high school students. And so I think that it's unusual. So it draws them in and then you're able to make paint with them. So I always thank you all. I mean, because that's really what this is about. I have a 1.5-year-old grandchild and I just think things are going to be radically different for them. And so it felt like as I was getting older, the situation around me was just seeming more and more urgent. And so I see this as a responsibility rather than to paint a picture of a landscape that looks serene. And there's, you know, there's a place for that as well. But for me as an artist, I was no longer content when I saw the things that were going on around me. So that's kind of what motivates me to keep going.
I love it. I think we can and do read white papers, but then it's difficult to discuss with a family member, but you can look at art together and then you can have a conversation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the bigger unit went with me to New York City. I was part of a residency at the Urban Soil Institute. And it was interesting to see people across the country and internationally working in areas of soil remediation, artists combined with scientists. And it was a game changer, I will say, for me. It's great always to find your tribe of people, because this isn't a typical gallery necessarily commercially viable type of art. And so at that point, it really connected me with a lot of the people across the country working at institutions academically, as well as just artists like me creating work around soil. And that was great. So it went to New York. It's here. I went to the carpet capital of the world outside Atlanta for Christmas and did another research trip. And so our Stainmaster carpets, our artificial turf, all of our laminate flooring, all of those things, and its effect on the community was really interesting. So this mobile lab will get, to some degree, gutted and replaced with a new body of work that looks at basically what we stand on: floor, turf, carpet, dirt.
This reminds me more of, well, maybe it's slightly in the same vein as a poetry slam. You're not necessarily selling the art. The art is to make people think and reflect.
Yes, absolutely. Start conversations, start debates. It may start with the process. The photographs are made with an alternative photographic process that is basically kitchen sink. You can do it in your kitchen sink. And that may be the entry point for someone that's just interested in how did you do that? And then the subject matter and the discussion can happen. And there's other folks that really may not care so much about the art aspect of it, but they can identify one of the photographs as a place they've been to, a place close to them. And some of them are very aware, obviously, because we hear about it all the time in the news, and others not so much. So it's been really interesting. And selfishly for me, it changes you little by little. When you fly from point A to point B, you miss so much. And so when we're driving through small towns we would never necessarily have ever gone to for any other reason, we get to see wonderful things too. So thank you, Calhoun, Georgia, for all the things that I would never have seen otherwise. But also perhaps the inequality of a community where it's really suffering and then the corporation is there and making money off of things that are really destroying their health. And so that's been really hard to take, but we wouldn't have seen it, I guess, if we hadn't driven there. And so that's been great. So I have the big unit. I have a one that looks like based on a plein air painting kit that opens up, and then a much smaller one around the corner that I can take with me when we fly somewhere. And so it's been fun to also think about bringing these units somewhere and opening them up on the side of a river site opens up conversation from artists or in Georgia from local police wanting to know, because I guess a lot of these sites do get a lot of press and media coverage. And so when I'm there with my quirky box full of little vials, we've had some interesting conversations.
I think your art captures the conflict because your art itself, the things you've made are gorgeous. They're beautiful. You're masterful. And they hurt a little bit. They're filled with toxic chemicals that were grown right into the very fabrics and the plants and the dyes that you're using.
Yes. Yes, it is. And for me, this idea of trying to have a sustainable process and create beauty in an unsustainable world, and the truth of it, of the amount of PFAS in a particular soil that I have here or water, I'm not a scientist, so I couldn't tell you exactly, but I know that it's there and it's lurking beneath the surface and in our bloodstream, right? So yes, it's disturbing to me, but I'm okay with also creating. There's a quote, art should comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable. And so that's sort of my motto. So
I love that. And is that your painting jacket there that has the walnut stains?
Yep. This is actually these fabrics down here, and there's some paper up there, is a process that is called eco-printing, where I'm taking plants from the site, and this was Virginia and Kentucky and Ohio, and basically steaming it into the fabric itself, and with the water from the Ohio and Susquehanna rivers. And so it's basically just one of the research lab jackets, and then I've just printed it with place. And so I think of all of this as placemaking.
Do you have anything else you want to say about toxics and what you want your art to say about toxics?
Basically that our insatiable consumption and the development of technology, although it brings with it some wonderful things. I wouldn't have been able to do a lot of the research I was able to do without the technology and the ability to Zoom with other scientists and artists. But on the other hand, our desire to just consume and consume has actually really resulted in the developing of newer and newer products to bring us newer and new things. And so it's twofold. It's capitalism and it's us just, I think, us moving away farther and farther from the earth that we're standing on and our urban environments that kind of divorce us more and more from actually being in nature. I know there's a lot of talk about nature therapy, forest bathing, those type of things. And I feel like we've really moved away from our real connection sometimes with the land and those people who are depending on it for their livelihood and are connected are really suffering too. So I just feel that if there is a way for folks to actually maybe visualize these kind of things in a different way, there might be a chance of shifting something. I'm hoping it can, but it certainly would be a sea change that has to start from more than maybe me just making paint. But I feel that it's just the urgency of the times demands that I speak about this with my students, that they have to realize what's going around them and the art that they make can be isolated and in their studio and maybe not have a relationship to what's outside. But if for those of them that are able to connect to what's going on around them, there's hope for radically reimagining what our future can be.
Beautifully said.
And I think the focus here at the university for incorporating art in with what previously would have been maybe strictly reserved for science or engineering or environmental engineering initiatives, the realization of the role that art can play and the beginnings of collaborations are really, really going to be the best hope of changing things, and that we can see that we need all hands on deck. And so we do have a number of initiatives right now on campus that are including arts. I say that in terms of not just art as illustration of or window dressing for what science can do, but looking at it, I guess I would say from a more feminist standpoint, a working with rather than on top of kind of approach. We're working together with scientists in the studios and artists in the labs. And to me, that's the best hope we have. And we're seeing a little bit of that already happening. And that's really exciting to be part of that.
I think it's really exciting. The whole digital commons, the very end of siloed learning. You know, there's nothing we do that doesn't integrate science and art and math and engineering and whatnot. And so putting it all together and working together collectively and having that different view, that bringing your right brain to it, that's going to help us see the whole picture.
Absolutely. We actually, that being said, have an interactive unit that is a collaboration with the School of Forestry, Forest Resources, and Graduate Art Intermedia that will be premiering at the Main Science Festival pretty soon and moving to other places as well and exhibited in this very gallery at the beginning of the summer. That's interactive touch screens using forest products, nanocellulose, which is something our art students are really experimenting with right now. And so we have a number of projects already besides my own personal that the department is doing. And I'm just really excited to see those students start to work with materials and be just integral in the processes that are happening right here in research. So it's been really cool.
Well, thanks for sharing that. I wasn't expecting to learn all about the wonderful integration, but it's what you're doing anyway. So it makes sense that that would be part of this. Before we close the interview, I'd like to ask you a little bit about your personal relationship with the natural world, if I might.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What's something you liked to do outside as a child?
Well, dig in the dirt. I would say that it's funny because you can't always see your art process when you're in it, but sometimes a mentor or a partner, or maybe with time, you're able to kind of step back and look at how what you do is reflected in something you might have done. And it took me a number of years to realize that these pigments that I dug, or the way that I approach a painting and excavate it, was very much not just from my landscape background, but was what I did as a kid. I dug burrows. I dug tunnels. So yeah.
It's who you are.
Yes.
And it comes through in your art. That's what's so cool about art. And it's the thread. You know, I think it's fascinating. You were also into landscape design.
Yes. I worked in landscape design before we moved to Maine. So I think that issues of land and power structures are at the heart of everything I do. And so this is all of it together.
Yes, you definitely have incorporated the water as well as the land and the environment. I'm always curious that in the 70s, we passed a Clean Air Act and a Clean Water Act, but we did nothing to protect the soil.
It's so true. It's so true. And I'm thinking about just how soil is an archive of who we are. And when you're digging down, you'll see families that lived maybe on your property that left a Hot Wheels toy in the ground or something like that. Deeper down, when I'm on my own land in Dover Foxcroft, there'll be the remains of, you know, a barn or something, an implement. And to just think, if we were able to see a cross-section, everything we do, positive and negative, it's a visual record.
Yeah. Archaeology, the science of dirt.
Absolutely.
What's one time you've been in nature and felt awe?
the first time I was on the Continental Divide, but that's a duh, right? But for me also, it's when I get out of my head and stop listening to the radio or the ruminations in my head on my drive, and I look around me and I'm on the top of Charleston Hill outside Dover Foxcroft, and I look down and I get to go, yeah, I live there. It's a beautiful place. I did not grow up with the changing of the seasons. I grew up with relentless sun, with occasional smog and a lot of humidity. And I have to say, you know, the changing of the seasons here, rather than a specific time, and however cliche that may sound, it's pretty much every other week, at least on my commute, there'll be a moment where I'm able to just look outside the window and just be in awe of it. I was doing a lot of work around the idea around showing up. If you're out there in the world, in nature, and you're actually showing up, something's going to speak to you and happen.
What's something in nature that you wonder about lately?
Rivers, because I am still pretty ignorant when it comes to thinking about rivers. And I've been creating a series of works, but I never considered were the tributaries, the streams. I really started to just focus in on how it's, you know, the veins of our body, basically. And so that to me has been something that's really struck me more recently, that I felt like I was just really unaware of the way that the rivers branch out, feed into the ocean, and the little creeks that feed there, and the streams, and then the ditches. And we're going to leave in a few weeks for the Cape Fear River Basin in North Carolina. So that research really started to make me start to think about this, and how can I translate that into a visual that would be different and have meaning? So rivers.
I think that's pretty visual already, thinking of a watershed as a human circulatory system.
Yes, absolutely.
And finally, what is your favorite baby animal?
Oh, I think that it would definitely have to be birds. I'm really, really drawn to thinking about nests and the way they create their habitats and the way a nest is built. I once was reading The Poetics of Space by Gaston Bachelard, and there's an entire chapter there about this beautiful description, but also poetry around the construction of a nest. From our viewpoint, from the bird's viewpoint, it was at the same time that nests just seemed to be in my path when I was hiking, etc. And in my own backyard, I do a lot of work with textiles. And at one point, a nest was on the driveway, and it had pieces of some of the strings and yarns and things that I had been using outdoors the summer before. And it's just birds. Baby birds are, I mean, it's just, and I've always been attracted to that. So, yeah.
I love it.
Don't tell my cats.
Susan, you're an inspiration to me. Your work invites deeper thought and discussions about polluted land and water in a way that's really accessible and super important. Thank you so much for being my guest today on What Mama Wants.
Thank you so much, Kate. It's been great.